This weekend at the non-residential weekend retreat, I was doing my best to impart the teachings on the four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abodes. Brahma means divine. It can mean lofty. It can mean high. Vihara can mean abode. And these abodes are not some place that we experience really outside of ourselves. It's not a place that we go to feel this divinity. But it's a place that we develop and establish within our hearts, within our minds, through the inclining of the heart, inclining of the mind, towards those experiences of loving kindness is the first divine abode. Sometimes you'll hear the word metta. That's the Pali word for loving kindness. And the next one is compassion. Sometimes you'll hear the word karuna. And the third one is sympathetic joy. Mudita is the Pali word for that. And the fourth one is equanimity, or upeka. And they say that this last one is the crowning, the queen or king of all the divine abodes. I didn't give a full talk on that this weekend, and so hopefully many of you who attended that weekend are here so you can have those complete teachings. And I hear that they will also be online. This talk will also be online for those who are not here, so we can spread the word. I talk about equanimity a lot when I'm offering the Dhamma here and there, because we need a large measure of that, really, to conduct our lives. We need a large measure of that so we can feel more and more in balance as we go about our lives. We need to have the clarity that equanimity of mind and heart gives us, so we know what action to take, or maybe it's not to take an action. We need to have the goodness of heart that metta infuses into equanimity, that allows us to be soft and gentle within that clarity, so that we're either acting or experiencing without acting whatever is going on with a great deal of gentleness. Equanimity helps us to not feed the unwholesome states of mind, because there's spaciousness enough to notice that they're there in the first place, without that quick reactivity of falling upon whatever is happening in the world when there's no equanimity. Equanimity allows us to nourish the wholesome, because it gives us a chance to notice when there are wholesome states of mind within us or within other people around us, so that we can nourish that. We can develop it. We can increase it. We can make it grow in ourselves and in others. The Buddha talked about equanimity in various ways, but one way that really attuned to my own life was this phrase that was used to describe what equanimity is. Resting the mind before it falls into extremes. Resting the mind before it falls into extremes. And so I have the experience myself of when the mind goes into the extreme of any kind of reactivity towards what is happening outside of me, or even reactivity towards how I'm feeling inside of myself, it's not restful. It's just, you know, pushing or pulling. And so the resting of the mind before it goes to the extremes gives me something that I can really feel in my own experience. The extremes are hatred in its various forms, ill will, resistance, even the hatred of that we act out in our words, in our deeds, in just the way sometimes our body language is. Another extreme is attachment, holding on to how we think it should be, that self-righteousness or that righteous indignation that is so close to the surface sometimes and lashes out, a mixture really of attachment and aversion. All of this rooted in ignorance. The ignorance because there's not the space to see what's happening before we act or before we decide not to act, which is also equanimity. It's so important, this quality nowadays, because we live in a time when fear and terror are rampant, of course. There are so many examples I don't even have to mention to you. They're used continuously to pull our attention. Fear about this, terror about that. It's so easy in our day and age to dwell on the negative, to talk about those events that are happening in the world, in our society, in our community, in our own family, that are so-called negative, unwholesome. And to distract ourselves from that, there's plenty of opportunity in our consumer society to find ways to cover that up by getting as much as we want or we think we need. Countless opportunities to encourage obsessive buying or obsessive wanting, accumulating. And so I'm part of this. I'm not going like this. It's like I can say this because I recognize it in my own experience. Where is the middle path? You know, I ask myself that a lot, or when my own children come to me, or grandchildren, I say, where can you find some balance? Where's the middle? Where can you act from a middle place between the fear and the obsession? Where can we rest the mind before it falls into extremes? How can we open to the outer conditions of the world with true compassion and not just swing our minds, our words, our bodies here and there without thinking, without knowing where is that coming from? How can we open to the inner conditions of our own inner life without adding another layer of judgment or condemnation or self-criticism to that? Mostly what I experience in hearing people talk about their lives is that deep reactivity to our own inner life, that way that we can very automatically, spontaneously just criticize ourselves, judge ourselves, and there's a lot of hurt in our society from that. How can we not push away ourselves with aversion? There's a very kind of hidden level of self-loathing, self-hatred. And sometimes it's not so hidden, it's just beneath the surface. So in the texts also, and in our own experience, we can feel equanimity to be a kind of balance, a kind of feeling grounded when we can know ourselves well, feel grounded in responding to the world, to our families, to community. There's a sort of even-mindedness. And sometimes it can be experienced by other people as such a strong neutrality that they're not feeling our passion or our care for them. And so this sometimes can be a challenge where we can really feel deeply balanced, deeply even minded and open-hearted at the same time. How do we do that? The subjective experience, when I look into my own life and how it is for me, how it feels for me when equanimity is there, is a spacious balance of mind and an openness of heart where there's some clarity in how to know myself in that moment. It has to be very quick a lot of times, what's going on within me. And there is space for choice so that even in a few moments, I can feel that space for choice and I know what choice to make, and I can feel fairly confident that I'm making the right choice or almost the right choice, good enough. You know, it's not like lashing out or pulling in or turning around and just walking off. So there's caring and there's clarity and there's a feeling that there's an absence of that, you know, scorpion stinger that's rising from the back that's going to come out and sting that other person or that situation that I'm involved in. Many people think that this equanimity is like being on a razor's edge, that precarious razor's edge that if you lean a little bit one way or lean a little bit the other way, we're just going to fall and not have our balance. But actually, from my own experience and those who have described that sense of equanimity to me, it's not like that at all. It's like a very wide stance where you feel like a mountain. And actually, in the precious teachings of the Buddha, it's described as a mountain sometimes, a mountain that can really experience whatever the weather patterns are of the time. There may be snow, there may be wind, there may be coldness. So I'm very aware of that here, coming from Maui. Or there may be lightning, there may be a lot of heat, there may be that kind of strong wind that's really hot that we feel on the mountain that I live on in Maui. So it's like that. There's an ability to have a strong, balanced, wide stance where you feel like you're not going to get knocked over, but you also feel everything that's happening. We want to feel what's happening. We want, because we want to know what's happening. Because when we know what's happening within us, to us, we can make a response that's wise, that's compassionate. I talked about free will this weekend. I've been wondering about that. I've been reflecting on that recently. Do we really have free will? People say sometimes, oh, if I meditate, I just won't be spontaneous anymore. You know, I'll be a blah, a doormat. You know, equanimity means like being a doormat. But let's check out, what is free will to us? Being spontaneous, what are we spontaneous with? Usually we're spontaneous with our habit patterns. Do we like all of our habit patterns? Are they really useful? Do they really serve? You know, I think it's a good question. Maybe a lot of you can answer that they do. But I have to answer that they don't always serve myself or the situation I'm in to the highest. So if I'm just being spontaneous and thinking that that's free will, then I might have to think again. Free will could mean to us that we have a choice to incline the heart, incline the mind, a chance to incline the mind and heart to something that is beneficial for the people around us and, of course, our own development, ourselves. And that takes equanimity to be able to do that, the spacious clarity and open-heartedness of mind. So it's not the precarious being on a razor's edge. On many of the Buddha's lists is equanimity. It's one of the seven factors of awakening, or the seven factors of enlightenment. And of course, it's one of the four divine or sublime states that I just mentioned now. It's said to be the crown and culmination of these divine states, so that when in life we respond to a situation with loving kindness, and that is not working, that's not helping the situation, and then we try to respond with compassion, and that isn't, again, working. Or maybe it's not the proper thing to respond with joy at the moment, sympathetic joy. Usually, in every case, we can respond with equanimity. And first of all, we'll know what the correct, where to correctly go. Maybe it is more compassion than loving kindness. Or maybe we just need to be quiet, compassionately quiet, and receive the suffering of that other person for a while. Just hold that pain for a few moments. So when nothing else works, usually equanimity works. It's said that if loving kindness, compassion, and equanimity were unconnected, loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy were unconnected to equanimity, they wouldn't really have their fullness, their effectiveness in our lives. Because if equanimity were not in loving kindness, it would dwindle to some kind of sentimental feeling. It wouldn't have that unconditionality that equanimity brings to loving kindness. It's said that equanimity endows compassion with courage and fearlessness to face the difficult parts of our lives. Because it's said that compassion actually is loving kindness that turns to pain, that turns to suffering. We use the word dukkha, suffering, a lot in the Buddha's teachings. If we did not have equanimity that's woven into that compassion, we would react to that pain. We would either close down, strike out, turn away, run away from it, oftentimes because it's too hard to face. So equanimity is a big part of both compassion and loving kindness. It doesn't allow us to be destroyed by helplessness or hopelessness, because it keeps the heart open in the face of whatever is difficult in the moment. So as we engage in any practice that we're doing, of training the mind and opening the heart, at the same time, it's an exploration. It's a discovery. When we do this mindfulness training, which I presume all of you are here because you do some mindfulness, among other things, we discover a lot of what is going on within us. We open to a lot. We have to be willing to explore that terrain of the mind and the heart that says, all right, I'm doing this because I'm not just going to open to what's beautiful. That's not why really I came to this path of practice. But I'm learning the tools to open to what's difficult too. So many of us, myself included, came to this path of practice thinking that I want to meditate because I want to be loving and kind and compassionate and say the right things and do the right things and maybe someday float in and out of places on a cloud and just experience all these pleasant experiences all the time. And it didn't take too long to discover that that isn't all that's happening. We get bits and pieces of that, of course. And as we grow into our practice and in this process, more and more happens like that. But a large part of our practice is exploring the depths of our minds and hearts and knowing without flinching what's going on here, opening to it, first with that mindfulness which is supported a lot by equanimity, which is supported a lot by that softness, that gentleness of mind, of loving kindness. And at times when it faces a lot of difficulty, it's supported a lot by the courage of compassion. We open to the awesomeness of the flowing on of life, the moment-to-moment experiences that are flowing through this mind and body, that when we deepen, when it's deepened into, we see the uncontrollability of it all. It's pretty awesome to experience that. To open to the uncontrollability of it all in ourselves, in our minds and hearts, takes a huge amount of equanimity. We begin to see with greater clarity the currents of change constantly affecting the experience of life. Now it's praise, now it's blame, now it's gain, then it's loss. There's joy, there's sorrow, there's fame, there's disrepute. These are the eight vicissitudes of life, the eight lokadhammas that the Buddha talked about. This affects all of us. It even affected the Buddha. It affected our own teachers. And in times in visiting my own teachers in Burma and before Munindraji died, teacher for myself and also Bhante here, we saw the ups and downs of his life. And he was a great model to us. They have been great models to us of living open-heartedly, open-mindedly, but some great balance within and between the two. We learn with clarity a way to disentangle the knots that we have inside of ourselves in relationship to that praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, joy and sorrow, the confusion around that, how to work with that inwardly, how to work with that outwardly. The Buddha often talked about these highs and lows. He said, to be happy, rest like a great tree in the midst of them all. Rest like a great tree in the midst of them all. Like strong roots in the ground, branches that are strong, that don't break in the winds of life. But of course we all know how challenging these winds of life, these outer conditions that arise can be. Painful habit patterns also get exposed when conditions outside are one way or another. We experience the conditions inside, the winds of change, of reactivity inside our own hearts. Shame, guilt, aversion, fear, judgment, criticism of ourselves in watching how we react. This creates layers and layers and layers of more confusion to get through. So it's said that equanimity allows these layers, these knots, to loosen, to come up, to be known, to loosen, to be disentangled. One time I asked Munindraji, why does it hurt so much? why does, when in meditating, in knowing the deeper, deeper and deeper how life is, it hurts. You know, the mind gets quiet, but you see more. And it's very painful to see more and more and more. And he said it hurts because the knots are tight and there is the disentangling of the tangle, the disentangling of the tangle within. And every time that inner tangle or that knot is loosened and more is seen within the knots of confusion in our mind, we need deeper and deeper, more rooted, grounded, abiding, wide, compassionate equanimity to be able to see whatever is being exposed now. So it's a constant exposé, you know, when we're in this practice of seeing what's going on. Being mindful doesn't mean we're going to always be more and more peaceful, but it can mean that we'll experience more and more equanimity, and that equanimity can seem actually still. We can abide in that stillness, and that can seem very, very peaceful. Of course there is peacefulness, but as we open our hearts and minds, it's not always that way. So many of you have been on the path of practice for a long time. Some of you may feel that you're just beginning, even though you've been on the path for 10 years. And some of you, maybe just first year, two, 3 or 4 years that you're on the path of practice. I think we all see that even if you've been on this path a few years, you see that there are cycles to our spiritual unfolding, to our spiritual process. And a lot of times there can be, like in the beginning, of falling in love with the Dharma or whatever path of practice you're on. And it can be like that honeymoon period, you know, of just floating in it. And then there can be times when you get a little calmness of mind, calmness of heart, a lot of equanimity, and things begin to open up and it gets difficult in there as things get exposed. We need equanimity then. And then there's a time in our practice when we feel we're like on a plateau. And that plateau can be a year, it can be two, it can be 10 years of feeling that we're just kind of, you know, still taking in all that we've learned about ourselves and the Dharma. And we're still kind of chewing on that or integrating that in our lives. And it doesn't feel like we're having any great openings. And it takes a lot of the equanimity that is patience to go through that. I bring this out because I've heard this from a lot of people on the path, that it doesn't feel like I'm getting anywhere. It doesn't feel like I'm opening the way I opened before. But the openings become more subtle sometimes. And it can seem like a plateau, but really there's a lot happening underneath. So one of the supports or counterparts of equanimity is patience. And I think that every time, I remember, all I have to do is mention that word. And I swear, people say, you know, patience, that's every time I give a talk on patience or mention patience, they say, that's the best thing. Patience, that's what helps me the most. All you had to do, all anybody has to do is mention the word. Patience is a big support, a counterpart, woven into equanimity. When we're opening really fast, or we think we're opening not enough or too slow, both times, all times, we need this patience, equanimity. Manindra used to say all the time, if you'll remember, Bhante, this is how it is right now. Surrender to the law. he would say, surrender to the law meaning the Dharma, the way things are. So here's my famous story that I've gotten a lot of mileage out of. So remember that about the law means the way things are. Surrender means accept. Just recognize how it is right now. That's what he meant by that. So this was a time of like a plateau in my practice life. And Manindra was visiting us, and he was actually recovering from an operation that he had in our hometown where we lived in Maui. And so I wanted everything to be just right for him because he was not well, and we were, you know, trying to feed him the right things and give him quiet and all of that. But in retrospect, I knew that I wanted him to see me and my family as like the perfect family, and you know, I'm such a good mother, and I have a quiet home, and my children are so respectful and obedient and all of that, you know. And so there were a lot of times when that wasn't so much like that, but it was okay, it was smooth enough. But here was a time when Manindra and I were eating at the table. I was sitting here, and he was sitting at the other corner, and we were near each other. And my youngest daughter, who was going through a change of her life, you know, going into her hormonal years, she's given me permission to say this, by the way. I have to give her a little something every time I tell a story about her. But so she was having an argument with her father, and it was getting more and more heated. And she was raising her voice. I didn't know what they were arguing about, but it was really passionate for her. And she was saying, no. And her father, just wonderful father, said, yes. And she was saying, no. And she stomped off. She stomped around me. They were in the family room there. She stomped around me with her father quickly behind her. And she went down the hallway, down this way, around Manindra. And Manindraji's eyes were darting here and there. He did not know what to do. I guess it isn't like that in India, you know? And so I was kind of slinking in my seat, you know, thinking, oh, get me out of here. This is not supposed to be happening. You know, this is disturbing Manindraji, and of course he's seeing me as a bad mother now, you know. My family isn't this good, peaceful family. And I was wanting to also get up, you know, huge reactivity. I was wanting to get up and say, shut up, you know. I was wanting to, you know, shake my daughter or something. And so she runs into her bedroom. She slams the door, and you could hear it lock. And her father says, open this door. No, open this door. No, with all her might, you know. Open this door or I'll kick the door in. Go ahead. So the door didn't get broken down, but it definitely got shook up a bit. And she opened the door, or the door was opened. I don't know what happened. And Manindra turns to me after, you know, this particular shouting match. He turns to me and he puts his right hand on my left forearm. And he looks at me with his calm, compassionate eyes. And he says, surrender to the law. This is how it is. And, you know, he could probably see in my eyes, like, what am I going to do? And what he was telling me is, just recognize this is what's going on right now. It really just that remembrance of his doing that puts me in that state of equanimity in the body-mind. And that phrase, surrender to the law, or, you know, like an equanimity phrase, this is how it is right now. Recognize what's going on right now. This is the quality of equanimity, when you can just stop and have that spacious mind, that open heart, that says, take in what's happening with a calm mind. That says, take in what's happening with a compassionate heart. There's a lot of pain in that interaction there. It also says, take in what's happening in your own heart. There's a lot of pain in that reactivity. It's painful to react that way and to actually admit it. So the point that I'm wanting to make about all that is, it's not only equanimity towards what's going on out there, but what Manindra was pointing out to me more than that is it's equanimity towards what's going on in here, towards our own reactive, judgmental minds and hearts that do its thing out of a patterned response with greed, hatred, and delusion. Unless we realize that's going on, it's really hard to make a step towards change. We really have to understand that, to accept that, to see those habit patterns with humility and honesty. And so these are the accompanying factors of equanimity. That clarity of mind, that space of mind, that open-heartedness, the patience, the honesty, the humility, can bring in that compassion. It said that compassionate action can't truly take place unless it is led by equanimity. In a talk one time I heard of the Dalai Lama where there were some, he was talking about the dilemma that he has with his country and how it is in relationship to what's going on in the world. He says that he can react a lot, you know, but someone asked him once, they've taken your land away, they've ruined the temples, they've hurt many people. You know, don't you want to get up and do something about it and, you know, react or some such question and comment like that? And the Dalai Lama said, they have taken away all this. Why should I give them my mind? The reactive mind. And so, you know, that's something to think about. Do we really help a matter, whether it's a social action matter or it's a family action matter, when we're in that state of reactivity, meaning that it's accompanied by greed, hatred, and delusion? So this is how it goes in our practice and in our lives. Being human requires us to open to what's going on, not just out there, but in here. It's the first step that we forget about. Especially, again, His Holiness the Dalai Lama asked activists to develop a measure of equanimity within themselves before going out into the world and doing their social action. Because if you're coming from a place of self-righteousness, of anger about what's going on, we don't have a clean effect on the world. There may be an effect, it may help, but it's not really clean. And it's not probably as long-lasting as it could be. So being human requires us to open and live wisely with how it is, outwardly and inwardly. and to move buoyantly, fluidly, among this praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, joy and sorrow. Not to be a doormat to life, but to do what we can. So I want to give you an example, because a lot of times people think that if I'm just equanimous, nothing will happen. You know, things will just go on as they go on, and I won't take the action, and, you know, people just step all over me. So, again, an example from Manindraji. We were in Bodh Gaya together, and we used to go to the Bodhi tree and sit under the tree very early in the morning, like 4 o'clock, and before the crowds came. And so when you walk into the temple in that area that's kind of, it's fenced in, there are many dogs. There are like packs of dogs. There were at that time. And what happens is these packs, they're territorial, and they have certain areas, of course. And so when you get to that area, they start sniffing your bag to see what, you know, should they stick around you, and maybe you'll open your bag out and up and give them something. So this happens as we go in. And Manindraji, the first time we went in, has noticed all of these dogs and said, where did, you know, so many dogs now, so many dogs. So then, you know, we had gone in a few times, and then this morning, this particular morning, we went to sit under the Bodhi tree. And I had some snacks in my purse, in my bag. And so the dogs came around, and sometimes you can just sit there and ignore and they'll go away. But then another pack came along, and they had a huge dog fight. It was really violent. And, you know, we were sitting there with all these dogs, and, you know, I just felt we scrunching up and moving away from them, and we felt a little bit trapped. Well, we didn't get hurt, and the dogs had their big fight. But after that, as we walked out, Manindraji said that he wanted to visit the superintendent of the temple, because he wanted to tell the superintendent that something must be done about these dogs. We weren't just going to say, this is how it is right now, and let the dogs do their thing. We had learned that some of them were rabid and had bit people, and rabies was being spread. But then some of them said, no, you cannot take the dogs away. They belong here too. But it was a health hazard. And so, but Manindra made his decision, right or wrong, depending on who was judging that decision. And we made an appointment with the superintendent, and he marched right in and sat down and, you know, very kindly said, something must be done with these dogs, you know. And so they talked, and they agreed that something would be done, and I'm not sure that it was. But you don't just sit there and let things happen like that. You take it in, you spacious about it, and then you take action with it. And so when I was in Italy recently, remembering that, you know, I was with my girlfriend, and I went to teach a course, and she went with me, and we were at the train station in Florence. And I had put her beloved coffee pot that she bought for her husband on the ground, and as I was waiting for her when she went to another store. And so then she approached, and she was trying to show me, look what I got. And I forgot the coffee pot behind me, you know, being as mindful as I am. And so somebody came along and picked up the coffee pot. And so she said, my coffee pot, where is it? And I turned around, and I noticed it was gone, and I noticed someone walking off with it. Well, it was a lady with, she had the bag on her, it was hanging down, and she was holding her little daughter's hand, or her little girl's hand, and just, you know, walking along at a kind of quick pace. So did I say, this is how it is right now? So I said, Donna, there it is. And she said, well, you know, what am I going to do? You know, I think she was wondering, and she told me she was wondering, should she just let them have it? So I said, no, that's your coffee pot. And so I just went after the, and I said, this is mine. And the lady said, oh, no, 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 no. This is mine. And I said, oh, excuse me. I looked and I said, oh, no, this is mine. And she said, roba, 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 like I was the robber. I kind of thought she said roba. She was maybe Italian, maybe something else. So I said, oh, no, 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 no. You roba. You roba. And so then, you know, I had to be strong enough, but so I took her hands gently, took the hand of herself and the little girl, and she didn't resist, and I just took them apart, and I took it back. And then I went back to the my girlfriend. So I wanted to give you a visual example that... Pardon? The Italian police to show up. Yeah. Nowhere to be found, probably having a cappuccino somewhere. Yeah, you don't just sit there. You know, of course you do something about it. I probably had some indignation, but, you know, I wasn't mean. So the extremes, the far enemy is reactivity. They call it the far enemy because you can know it from afar. You can sense it. It doesn't take too much to know that this is reactivity, acting in an unwholesome way with either greed or hatred, and definitely accompanied by delusion because not knowing. The near enemy is called indifference, complacency. So, you just kind of, you are that doormat, or there is that kind of doormat attitude within. So neither of these is, both of these are the opposite of equanimity. And indifference is not equanimity at all. Indifference may be characterized by a kind of calmness, but it isn't a true connection with what's going on. In indifference, you're kind of disconnected with what's going on. There's a lot of delusion in indifference. In equanimity, there's a lot of clarity. There's a lot of connection with what's happening within and without, around you. There's a great teaching, and it comes from either the Zen or the Tibetan or maybe the Theravadan. Equanimity is love that can encompass everything yet possess nothing, can open to everything yet possess or not hold on to anything. And the Tibetans describe this kind of mind as like the sky, or the space. If you throw paint into space, it gets thrown into that space, but it doesn't stick anywhere. So situations can come and go, but it doesn't have to stick anywhere. One can see it as, this is how it is, this is coming, this is going, this is changing, but it doesn't have to stick anywhere. And in the deepest sense, we don't have to get personal about it. We don't have to take it personally. We don't have to create a, this is happening to me. this is me, this is mine, this is who I am. So equanimity, supporting our spiritual practice, supporting mindfulness, supporting loving kindness, supporting compassion, supporting sympathetic joy also, because when equanimity is there with sympathetic joy, there's not a chance to compare. Why is that person having joy and not me? There's not a chance to, judge. It's just completely open and happy for that person in their happiness. The equanimity that can say, this is how it is right now, and if I can respond in a way that's wise and compassionate, it doesn't have to be this way forever. So I'd like to end with this is a longer talk, as you can see. I'm shortening it. So I'd like to end with another vision that helps to give me a sense of equanimity in my own body and mind. And that was a memory I have of being with Manindraji when we visited the Ganges River, when I was in India with him the first time. And it was our last day, and we were in Varanasi. And we went out, as many people do, on one of the boats on the Ganges River. Manindra always said to me and many times that he'd like me to go there where they burn the bodies. And he wanted me to see the burning bodies at the ghats along the river. And also he said, maybe someday you'll see a body floating in the river. I mean, this is only your meditation teacher would want this for you. So we did go before dawn, and we went on a boat with other people. And it was a very clear and warm, beautiful morning. And the sun hadn't risen yet. And so across the river, you could see on the horizon, beyond the where the river ends, the sun was rising on the Ganges. And it was a very, very spacious feeling that I had there. So on one side was the sun rising, and the other side was the burning bodies, because they burned them that early in the morning. And so there was this beauty on one side, and the other side was something that was a little hard to be with, even though I'd worked in the cemetery for 20 years. And, I could ask myself during that time, just not with a question, but just with an inclination of the mind, can I hold both of these, the beauty here and the hard to be with on this side? And then the teacher, being very grateful for having met a teacher. It's said to be one of the four precious things about spiritual life, that you meet a teacher that you can trust. And so I feel that's been a very precious thing in my life, to meet a teacher I can trust. And he was like a son to me. He called me his mother. So, of course I respect him very much, but I could hold his hand. That's why I wanted... He wanted me to hold his hand. So I was holding his hand on this one side. And then very dear to me, someone on this side. And then looking to the banks, on the banks of the river, the poor and the destitute. Indeed, there are people that come up in boats and they try to ask for alms. And, sometimes they came and bumped up against us. And so... that too, could I open to the beauty of that, of having a teacher, and then, seeing the harshness of the world, and open to that also, is feeling my heart go out to these people, not easy to hold both at one time. The rawness of life for them. You know, they don't have good fortune, usually. Bits of happiness, but hard for them. But the good fortune I have to be able to do these, visit a teacher and travel in this way and take in the Dharma. Opening to both of those things. So being able to have the mind and heart wide enough to be open to the beauty of life and yet the rawness of life. Having the heart and mind opened soft enough to be able to take it in and not to close down with what's harsh, not to cling to what's beautiful. So this is the quality of equanimity that we're all learning in our practice. I'd like to end with them. This is a poem by William Stafford from his book, The Way It Is, and it's called The Gift. Time wants to show you a different country. It's the one that your life conceals, the one waiting outside when curtains are drawn, the one grandmother hinted at in her crochet design, the one almost found over the edge of the music after the sermon. It's the way it is, and you have it. It's a balance, the taking and passing along, the composting of where you've been and how people and weather have treated you. It's a country where you already are, bringing where you have been. Time offers this gift in its millions of ways, turning the world, moving the air, calling every morning, here, take it, it's yours. So let's sit for a moment and just let those words disappear. Thank you for listening to the Dhamma. Thank you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu is traditional way of saying well spoken. And Manindraji, again, used to say, when he used to make me say that, actually, at the end of his Dhamma talk, even if there were just the two of us. He used to say, now say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So I'd say, okay, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Because he said, when you say that, it means that you are in alignment with the Dhamma, that you make your heart in alignment with the Dhamma. And he wanted me to be that way. So I don't mind if you stretch while anybody wants to ask a question, if you have any, or you want to express a concern of yours or a confusion about your path of practice, and maybe I can answer or not. Yes.
How do you know if you're reacting?
How do you know if you're reacting or acting? Well, in terms of reactivity in being the far enemy of equanimity, in those terms, reacting means when we're acting out with greed or hatred. Mm-hmm. And we're not, you know, we don't have the, we can tell we don't have the space to really know what to do. It's, we just lash out. But when it's with greed or hatred, it's, you know, definitely reacting. So in our Western terms, we call a better way to do that responding, right? Responding. So we can respond with non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. But we need some space, some choice to do that. I think a good way, it's just coming to mind right now, a good way that I've learned how to develop equanimity is to just not say or do anything right away, but to make a habit of saying, I need some time to think about this. So, you know, thank you for, now I know what you're feeling, what's going on with you, so can you give me some time to think about this or to reflect on this? And it gives me some time to sort things out, to get it together a little bit. That's just a practical way. Yeah.
I had a question about equanimity's connection with metta. And is the, in describing the qualities of equanimity, you didn't include warmth. But I had the sense when you were talking about it that there is a warmth to the equanimous mind.
Yeah, there is a warmth. And the qualities that are in metta, like connection. Metta has a quality of really connecting with the other person, and so does equanimity. Metta has a quality of being gentle and open and soft and warm, and so does equanimity. But it may not seem like that. It could seem sterile. But inside, we can feel the warmth. And sometimes we need to make an effort to express that warmth. So I see that a lot of times in me, that's a place where I need more work. Because I can be equanimous, I can be sort of balanced, but the other person isn't getting that I'm caring, that there's some warmth, there's some metta there. So I really have to pay extra attention to that. It's late and we're quiet. So I think it's the time to close then, huh? Okay. So let's maybe close with a little bit of silence. And I'll do maybe 5 minutes of metta practice. How's that? Yeah? Okay. So bringing our attention to our heart center around the physical heart. And breathing into and out from that area just for a few breaths. And then offering loving kindness to those immediately around us, the front and the back and to our sides, radiating like a warm light or a sense of just simple warmth around us, just as I wish to be safe and protected. I wish this for you as well. May you be safe and protected. And then opening to include all the beings in the room, just as I wish to be peaceful and happy. May all beings here be peaceful and happy. Extending out to our family members, wherever they are, just as I wish to be healthy and strong, may you all be healthy and strong. And to all beings here in our community, those we know, those we don't know, just as I wish to live with ease of well-being, may all beings here and in all directions live with ease of well-being. May we dedicate the merit of this beneficial energy that we have developed here through our practice, through our sharing. May we share the merit with each other, with our families, with all beings everywhere. And by the sharing of this merit, may all beings be benefited. May all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings be liberated.